Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today's episode is dedicated to my mom. It's her birthday this week, and I asked her a few weeks ago for her request on who I should cover during her birthday week. Her request? Ginger Rogers. And what a fitting request. Not only because Ginger Rogers was an impressive woman, but because she had a very close relationship with her mother. They were best friends throughout her entire life. My mother is also one of my very best friends, so this is a great tribute to the birthday girl. So, happy birthday, Mom, and I hope you enjoy Ginger Rogers' story. I'm going to start off in someone else's words right off the bat here. Not just anyone else's words. Ginger Rogers' words herself. Her autobiography is my primary source for this episode. You never know what you're going to get when you dive into a celebrity autobiography. Some are heavily embellished, some contain downright made-up facts, and some individuals were so out of it from one substance or another that they have no idea if their recollections of the past are actual truths. But Ginger Rogers is different. Well, first of all, she did not drink, and she definitely didn't do drugs. She watched carefully as her peers turned out autobiographies and when other authors penned biographies of the stars. She was really put off by the sensationalized accounts that she read, by the once secret dirt on others that she read spilled about the pages. She didn't want to do that. She wanted to tell her story accurately, in style, and with much respect to everyone who walked through her life story. So, Ginger Rogers, My Story, was my primary source for the information I'm about to share with you. And I will begin with the exact words Ginger began her book with. My mother told me I was dancing before I was born. She could feel my toes tapping wildly inside of her for months. Prophetic as it was, my birth was a dramatic one in the steamy heat of a Missouri summer. Ginger Rogers was born as Virginia Catherine McMath on July 16, 1911, to her strong-as-nails mother, Leela, whose less-than-stellar husband had left her abandoned and all alone. She did have her parents around and they were very supportive, but she decided to move to Independence, Missouri from Kansas City after her husband left. She wanted to get away from him and his family, but she also wanted to prove that she could be an independent woman and make it on her own. Leela secured a secretarial position on the morning of July 15, 1911, made arrangements to begin work on August 1st since she was currently 9 months pregnant, stopped off at the neighborhood drugstore for a couple of things, where she went into intense labor, called the doctor and asked him to meet her at her home, toughed her way the few blocks home, met the doctor, and, after a long and difficult labor, welcomed into the world a healthy baby girl at 2 a.m. that night. Leela didn't know it then, but she had just given birth to a little baby girl that was going to showcase some of the most impressive talent of her time to the world. A remarkable little girl entered the world on that hot, sweltering Missouri night. Ginger wasn't Leela's first baby. She had a baby 2 years prior who died during childbirth. During the labor, Leela's husband and the doctor made the decision to use forceps to help get the baby out, without consulting Leela, the woman who was actually giving birth to the baby. In the process of using the forceps, the baby's neck was broken. It was horrific and devastating. So Leela was so happy to have her healthy baby girl to love forever. And she did just that. True to her word, Leela reported for her first day of secretarial work at the Sand Company on August 1st, with her two-week-old baby in tow. Baby Virginia, later Ginger, I'll just start calling her that now, was secured snugly in a basket while her mother worked for $6 per week. Leela's mother had pleaded with her daughter to please allow her to come and stay with her to help, to let her watch her granddaughter while she went to work. But Leela was strong. She was independent, and she refused to cave in to any kind of assistance. She was going to do this all by herself as long as she could. As Ginger grew out of the basket, Leela created a little safe haven outside of her office desk window for the baby. Well, safe is maybe not the best word to use, especially by today's standards. She laid out a blanket under a sprawling weeping willow tree and made some kind of makeshift barrier around it, set a couple of toys down next to her, and called it good. Every now and then, Leela would yell out of her window, "Mommy's right here!" And every now and then, a stranger would yell into Leela's window and ask if they could take her adorable little girl down the road for some ice cream, which Leela always allowed. That is, until baby Ginger went missing. Before Ginger was even a year old, Leela looked out the window to do her obligatory shout-out and check into her baby sitting unattended in the yard, only to discover that her baby was gone. She thought maybe one of those kind strangers took her to get ice cream without asking, so she actually waited it out for a little while, assuming that her baby would reappear. Okay, doesn't it seem like this child is maybe enjoying a little too much ice cream, considering she's an infant? Well, baby Ginger wasn't out for ice cream, and she did not reappear. Leela checked the drugstore. Nothing. Then she ran to the train station across from her office building. Nothing. Did someone kidnap Ginger and was trying to take off in the departing train? Leela and a police officer just barely missed the train as it left down the tracks. A distraught Leela took a train to Kansas City, to her parents' home, even though that departing train was going to St. Louis. She just didn't know what to do. The front page of the next morning's paper said, "Virginia McMath kidnapped." Baby Virginia, Ginger, was found in Texas. The kidnapper, Leela's estranged husband, Eddins, Ginger's father. The man who had never wanted any part of her life thus far suddenly wanted all of her. Here is further proof that Leela Rogers was a badass of a woman. She took matters into her own hands in getting her child back. She took a train to Texas all alone, and with the help of a couple of very special guardian angels there, she found Eden's home, she went there, and she snatched her child back. Eden's attempted to kidnap Ginger again when she was 3 years old, but he was unsuccessful that time. And that time, Leela finally officially divorced him, took him to court, and the judge said that if he ever attempted to kidnap Ginger again, he would be going straight to prison. Ginger Rogers never saw her father again. Always aspiring for some kind of greatness, Lila Rogers left for Hollywood in 1915, leaving her four-year-old daughter to live with her parents in Kansas City. Ginger lived there with her grandparents, plus her aunt Virginia, who she was named after, and Virginia's young children. It was a full and happy home. It was Ginger's toddler cousin who gave her the name Ginger. The little girl couldn't say Virginia, but she could say something that sounded like Ginger. So the name Ginger stuck. Lila didn't run to Hollywood to become an actress like most young women there were doing. She wanted to sell stories to filmmakers. But while she was gone, her daughter was taking her first small steps towards her path as an actress. Ginger Rogers' first official acting role was in a local commercial that would be shown before silent films in Kansas City. It was a commercial for a local optician. She was so proud for her friends and neighbors to see her on the silver screen before their favorite motion pictures. And Lila, she did become a screenwriter in Hollywood. It wasn't quite as difficult as it would be today. They were whipping out simple scripts for their silent film shorts left and right back in that day. But still, she went out there with a goal, and she achieved that goal. She pretty quickly became the primary scriptwriter for child star Baby Marie Osborne's films at Fox. Then Fox sent her to New York to join their East Coast studio as a scriptwriter. Once settled there, she sent for her now six-year-old daughter to join her. Ginger's grandfather sewed a tag into her waistcoat with her name and address on it and sent her on her way. All alone on a train voyage from Kansas City to New York City, at 6 years old. In 1918, Lila felt compelled to pay her patriotic duty during the escalation of World War I. She became one of the first 10 women to join the United States Marine Corps. This was indeed very patriotic of Lila, but it also meant that, after just a little over a year of being reunited, Ginger was making the return solo trip to Kansas City. As a female Marine, Lila worked primarily as a publicist for the Marine Corps during her enlistment. While visiting a military hospital, Lila met and fell in love with a man named John Rogers. The two were married upon their release from military duty in May of 1920. And Ginger could finally be reunited with her mother again, now with a new father too, who she instantly loved. The family moved to Fort Worth, Texas, and embarked on a new family life together. In Fort Worth, Lila got a job with the Fort Worth Record as a vaudeville and motion picture reviewer, and she was good at it. She made many new connections and friendships through this job, and her position allowed little Ginger the opportunity to meet vaudeville performers like Jack Benny, George Burns, and Gracie Allen. It also offered Ginger the opportunity to learn how to dance, which, to no surprise at all, she was a natural at. So natural, it seemed like she was born to dance. The first thing she learned was the Charleston. And in the fall of 1925, 14-year-old Ginger Rogers won a local Fort Worth Charleston dance contest. She was advanced to the Dallas competition, and she won that, making her the Texas State Charleston champion. As the state champion, she went on a four-week tour across Texas. Seeing the potential of her daughter's great talent, Lila went all in on creating a dance troupe with Ginger at the center of it. She secured talent, she made all the costumes, and she organized all of the engagements. Lila and Ginger traveled with the troupe all over the United States for 3 years, wowing audiences far and wide. Ginger would not only dance, but she would sing and showcase her piano skills as well. And the show also included comedy skits, your typical vaudeville stuff. Ginger eventually teamed up with bandleaders Ed Lowery and then Paul Ash. She was an audience hit wherever she performed. Paul Ash invited Ginger out to New York to perform with his orchestra in the summer of 1928. Ginger was only 17 years old, and she'd traveled all over the United States performing her song and dance. And now her mother thought she was ready for New York. Ginger had a grueling performance schedule in New York. They performed 5 shows per day, Monday through Friday, and then 6 shows each day on the weekends. She was a teenage girl and definitely not living the life of a typical teenage girl. Or going to school, as you probably already realized. She was too busy working to go to school. Ginger was also busy falling in love. Her aunt's former boyfriend came to see one of her shows when she was back on the road again after her New York engagements. His name was Jack Culpepper, and Ginger had had a childhood crush on him for years. Once Jack saw Ginger all grown up, well, if you call 17 grown up, he saw her in a much different light. Within just a couple of months, 17-year-old Ginger walked away from her budding career and married 26-year-old Jack Culpepper. Jack was a performer as well, so Ginger's position was now as dutiful backstage wife. She instantly regretted marrying Jack, and the marriage was over pretty quickly. Her mother Leela's marriage was over too. Time for a new chapter for the mother and daughter super team. Back to show business and on to bigger and better things. Ginger performed on Broadway after her marriage, a musical called Top Speed. In the audience of the premiere in December of 1929 were some pretty big Hollywood faces, including head of Paramount Pictures, Adolph Zukor. Zukor invited Ginger to their Long Island studio for a screen test. They loved her, and she was signed to a 7-year movie contract with Paramount Pictures. Ginger Rogers was about to become a movie star. Ginger Rogers' first feature film was the 1930 romantic comedy Young Man of Manhattan, starring Claudette Colbert and Norman Foster. Ginger was still doing some work on Broadway as well. It was during rehearsals of the musical Girl Crazy in the fall of 1930 when the production's dance director called in a friend to help dial in the show's dance routines. This friend was a professional dancer, one of the best. The director asked him to do a number with Ginger. And this was the first time Ginger Rogers ever danced with Fred Astaire. Soon after, Fred asked Ginger out on a date. He wanted to take her out dancing. She happily accepted. The date went very well. Ginger recalled that their kiss at the end of the night in Fred's Rolls Royce would not have passed the Hays Code. Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire didn't fall madly in love and live happily ever after, though. Well, not in the traditional sense. They would be partners, just not romantic partners. Luckily for all of us, they would become one of the most amazing dance duos the world had ever seen. Or has ever seen since. But not quite yet. First, Hollywood was taking notice of Ginger Rogers. Yes, she was signed under contract with a big film studio, but she was signed to Paramount's East Coast studio. Leela asked Paramount to let them out of the contract, they agreed, and off to Hollywood, Ginger and Leela went. A new chapter with a new film studio. Ginger completed her initial 3-picture deal with RKO, and she began freelancing with other studios, keeping very busy. including the successful musical 42nd Street in 1933, which was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And also notable is Gold Diggers of 1933, which was also Oscar nominated. She starred alongside Thelma Todd, Ruby Keeler, Zazu Pitts, Joan Blondell, and Dick Powell in these early films. Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire first appeared on screen together in the 1933 musical Flying Down to Rio. And the rest is dance floor history. Seriously, who does not find the purest of enjoyment in watching Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire work their dance magic together? We already know that the two are compatible off the dance floor. In fact, Ginger Rogers recalled that the only reason they didn't proceed with their chemistry-filled romance was because she moved to Hollywood and he stayed in New York. And I think the fact that they didn't end up dating or married was a good thing, because that could have easily prevented their professional partnership from ever forming. Fred and Ginger go together like peanut butter and jelly, like salt and pepper. When you think of Fred Astaire, you think of Ginger Rogers. And when you think of Ginger Rogers, you think of Fred Astaire. Fred and Ginger can be used as a whole, like Laurel and Hardy or Abbott and Costello. As in, it sometimes feels strange to say one name without attaching the other to it. Fred Astaire's original dance partner was his sister, Adele. They started when they were just children. They had been a very successful vaudeville and Broadway team. Adele left show business and got married in 1932, leaving Fred Astaire in New York without a partner. Although he did find a romantic partner shortly after, his new wife, Phyllis. He thought he would head west like tons of other entertainers, get a little taste of that Hollywood action. Fred Astaire was cast in a supporting role in the 1933 film Flying Down to Rio, and as I mentioned before, his dance partner in this movie was the one and only Ginger Rogers. Sparks flew all over that dance floor, and everyone in the vicinity was hit by them. They had no idea what kind of history they were embarking on in that moment. "I thought Ginger and I looked all right together," Fred Astaire recalled of their first on-screen dance number, "but I was under the impression that we weren't doing anything particularly outstanding." Well, RKO definitely knew what was happening was outstanding, and they couldn't wait to capitalize from it. Fred and Ginger's next pairing was in The Gay Divorcee the following year. Another dance floor hit for the hottest new dance duo in the nation. It was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, which It Happened One Night took home that year. Both Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers were perceived as a little difficult to work with at times by others, but they were highly compatible together. Ginger was often criticized for her confidence, for advocating for her career in a good old boys' club world. And Fred was often criticized for his intense perfectionism and pushing other partners to tears as a result of it. But Fred and Ginger, well, they were just meant to be. It wasn't all sunshine and rainbows all the time, though. They had their moments. One notable rift was while they were putting together the dance sequence for Cheek to Cheek in Top Hat. Ginger had a blue feather gown designed specifically for that number. And Fred Astaire hated it. All of those feathers would get in the way of his dancing. But Ginger stood firm, and she won. It was a beautiful dress, and I've only seen it in black and white. "Our emotions were high-pitched," Ginger recalled. "He didn't like my dress, and I didn't like being put to the test." Watching that dance sequence now, which I have several times over the years, you would have no idea that there was any tension lurking under the surface. But Fred Astaire was not happy. "I never saw so many feathers in my life," he said. "It was like a snowstorm. They were floating around like millions of moths. I had feathers in my eyes, my ears, my mouth, all over the front of my suit. The feathers kept flying, the wardrobe lady shook the dress and sweepers swept them up. it got to be funny after a while. It turned into one of those annoying incidents that became pretty funny in hindsight. The two laughed about the feather incident for years and years to come. Ginger Rogers paired up with Fred Astaire for a total of 10 movies, most of them between 1933 and 1939. Swing Time was Ginger Rogers' favorite of their films. Mine too, I think. They reunited in 1949 for their final collaboration, MGM's The Barclays of Broadway, the only Technicolor Fred and Ginger film. When they reunited for this film, a decade after their last movie together, they fell magically back into sync with each other as if they had just shared their last dance the day before. Although what I said before is true, that when we think of Ginger Rogers, we instantly think of Fred Astaire, that Fred and Ginger is its own entity, it's really important for us to understand that Fred Astaire did not define Ginger Rogers. Ginger had a successful vaudeville, Broadway, and film career before pairing up with Fred Astaire, and she continued to build her career as an actress outside of their dance collaborations. That was an obstacle she faced often. She watched Fred Astaire get all the acclaim while she was seen as just the woman who was led around the dance floor by the male dance genius. But do you think you could be led around the dance floor by Fred Astaire and the dance numbers that you've seen them in together? I sure couldn't. There's a well-known quote about this that you may have heard. Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did. She just did it backwards and in high heels. So, stepping away from Fred Astaire, as much as I love him, we're going to talk about Ginger now and what her life held outside of her professional partnership with him. Ginger was having a ball in her new life in Hollywood. She dated casually, and as soon as she got to Hollywood, she began meeting key Hollywood figures as she attended some of the hottest social events and dined at the hottest restaurants and clubs. One such figure was another relative newcomer to Hollywood, Howard Hughes. And Howard Hughes took an instant liking to Ginger Rogers, as he was later known to do with women. They went out a few times at that point early on, but there was another man who had taken notice of Ginger too. And it just happened to be her biggest celebrity crush, actor Lou Ayres. Something that only seemed possible in her daydreams happened when he called her and asked her out. Their chemistry was undeniable, and it spilled over onto the silver screen when they co-starred in Don't Bet on Love shortly after they began dating. Ginger Rogers was in love. Ginger Rogers married her celebrity crush turned real-life romance on November 14, 1934, when she was 23 years old. Just think of the life this girl had already lived, and she was only 23. She had accomplished so much, and now she had found a love that made her so happy. Was it too good to be true? Well, it was Hollywood in the 1930s, so it probably was. Ginger wrote in her book, quote, "At this point in my professional life, I was number 3 at the box office with Fred. But with Lou at home, I was 0. Our marital problems were coming to a head," end quote. She talked about how it all began with their financial agreement. Lou had insisted they sign a pre-op, and Ginger was fine with that. She didn't really read it over too much. She just thought it was a little technicality that she had to sign to join her with the man she loved. And then they would fall into happily wedded bliss together. Now, I know this sounds outrageous by today's modern standards, but Ginger was so excited to become a submissive little housewife. She still wanted to work some, but what she really wanted to do was keep a home and make her husband happy. To clean her husband's home and have pork chops or meatloaf on the table for him every night. She wanted Lou to make all of the decisions in their life and to have complete control of the finances. This was the culture she knew, and this was the culture she wanted. But Lou, much more aligned with the standards of today's young couples, wanted everything to be separate. He wanted their money separate, and he wanted them to buy their own groceries and split costs and bills right down the middle. Ginger wasn't expecting that, and she didn't like it. To her, this was a sign of distrust. It led to the start of some tension between the couple. Another contributing factor was the vibrant nightlife in 1930s Hollywood, which Lou was all in for. Ginger didn't drink. She was very opposed to alcohol. So while Lou wanted to party the night away and drink until dawn, that kind of lifestyle just didn't fit with Ginger's value system. Ginger Rogers' dreams had come true when she married her silver screen idol. But it was indeed too good to be true. As difficult as it was to face the reality of it all, Ginger decided it had to end. She left in May of 1936, 18 months after her dreams had first come true. She was 24 years old now and thought that she had found forever love twice, only to be completely let down. She was going to be okay, though. She had that same strong blood as her mother had running through her veins. Ginger took this turning point in her life and ran with it. She bought a piece of land and had a home built. This is really sweet. She built it for her mother and asked her mother if she could live in it with her. But it would be her mother's house. She never forgot all of the things that her mother had done for her. The women planned the design of their brand new home with entertaining in mind. And Ginger followed through with that entertaining once the house was completed. There were tennis courts and a swimming pool and a large flagstone patio for barbecuing and relaxing. Alcohol was not allowed in Ginger and Leela's home, but they didn't need it to have a good time. During this time, Ginger dated Howard Hughes again, Jimmy Stewart, and Cary Grant, amongst a few other eligible bachelors of the time. Howard Hughes, in fact, proposed to her with a 5-carat diamond engagement ring. But he was controlling, possessive, manipulative, judgmental, extremely jealous, and even possibly had Ginger followed when he wasn't with her. Once Ginger found out that he was also seeing another woman, even though they were engaged, she had the weapon she needed to end the abusive relationship for good. This really has nothing to do with her life story, but I just have to share it with you. Back to her love of entertaining, Ginger hosted a roller skating party in March of 1937, inspired by her roller skating dance scene in Shall We Dance, which she and Fred Astaire were currently filming. Ginger was dating Alfred Vanderbilt at the time. Yes, those Vanderbilts. So the couple rented out the Roller Dome in Culver City and invited quite the array of stars. Get a load of this guest list, and remember, they're all on roller skates. Joan Crawford and her husband at the time, French Otone, Humphrey Bogart and his wife at the time, Mayo Metho, Cesar Romero, Cary Grant, and tons more. The menu included spaghetti, chili, tamales, ham, hot dogs, hamburgers, and baked beans. A little bit of everything there. Things got pretty exciting when Humphrey Bogart decided he was a freestyle roller skater. I'm going to read directly from Ginger Rogers' autobiography because she tells the story so well. She wrote, quote, "About 2 hours into the party, I saw chairs and tables lined up in the middle of the rink. 'What's going on?' I asked Joan Crawford. 'Well,' she answered, 'you'd better look fast while he's on his feet. Bogey's over in the corner and is preparing a running start to jump over those chairs or dance with them.' I looked just as he came out of a shadowy corner. Before you could say scat, he jumped over the first chair, headed for the second, and picked up the third en route to do a cartwheel with it." "Oh, Bogey," moaned George Murphy. "Don't do that again. You'll break your neck." Paying no attention to anyone, he challenged himself again. This time, when he reached the third chair, his hand skipped off. He missed it clean and ended up sliding about 15 feet on the seat of his trousers. Everyone gathered around him as he got to his feet. Bogey stood up to his full skate height, brushed the dust off his suit, and said in that charming lisp, "I used to travel with a circus and did this for a living. I was pretty good at it then. I just haven't done it in a while." End quote. And to imagine no alcohol was involved. I could see Bogey and Mayo smuggling some in though, couldn't you? Shifting back to Ginger's career. She really wanted to secure more serious roles, something other than musicals. When she heard that John Ford was directing Mary of Scotland with Katharine Hepburn to star, she became determined to be cast in the role of Queen Elizabeth. But she knew she would be brushed off before she could even audition if she showed up as Ginger Rogers. They would want a different style of actress for the role. So she came up with a grand plan to get that role without John Ford even knowing that he was casting Ginger Rogers. She snagged the help of a makeup artist and costume designer at RKO and became Lady Ainsley, British accent and all. Her agent, Leland Hayward, was in on the scheme too. He told Ford that he had secured Lady Ainsley for consideration, who was well established on the London stage and was a dear friend of Mary Pickford and staying at Pickfair during her visit to the States. Lady Ainsley wasn't too interested in the downgrade from the London theater scene to Hollywood films, but he had convinced her to try out for the part. And John Ford ate it all up. She was unrecognizable as she auditioned for the part. Well, except to the keen Katharine Hepburn. And she was not pleased. By the next day, it had been leaked to gossip columnist Luella Parsons, and she spun it as a distasteful, practical joke. Only Ginger did it as a way to prove her ability. In the end, she didn't get the part. I'm guessing Katharine Hepburn had something to do with that. It was shortly after this that the infamous Katharine Hepburn and Ginger Rogers mink coat incident occurred. Ginger had just got a new mink coat and proudly strolled by the director's building on the RKO lot wearing it. George Stevens complimented her from a second-story window. And then a second head popped out to see it. Katharine Hepburn. She disappeared for a moment and returned with a large glass of water, which she poured all over Ginger Rogers and her brand new mink coat. "If it's a real mink, it won't shrink," she snarkily said, as her head disappeared from the window. According to Ginger, Katharine Hepburn always seemed to hold some kind of hostility towards her for some reason. The two were paired up in 1937 for Stage Door. Ginger finally got her opportunity to showcase her acting talents, not just her dancing talents. The movie was a big hit, and Ginger's performance was applauded. The role that Ginger had been waiting for came in 1940, Kitty Foyle. RKO bought the rights to the book as a vehicle specifically for Ginger Rogers. When she first read the novel, though, she hated it. It was too spicy, too many inappropriate love scenes, she thought. Once it was rewritten to be adapted for the screen, she loved it. "I realized it was one hell of a script," she recalled, "and was convinced that whoever played the role would end up with an Oscar. I saw it vividly." Ginger was right. At 29 years old, she won the Academy Award for Best Actress for her work in Kitty Foyle. Out of the 73 films that Ginger Rogers starred in her life, Kitty Foyle was hands down her favorite role and the one she was most proud of. Shortly after her huge success with Kitty Foyle, Ginger purchased an 1,800-acre property on the Rogue River in Oregon. She wanted desperately a place of solitude far away from Hollywood. She and Leela once again designed their home, plus the barns and a dairy facility, so it was the perfect private haven, and a working dairy farm. This ranch was Ginger's home for the rest of her life. She had her home in California too, but spent as much time as she could at the ranch. And later in life, she lived exclusively at the ranch. It was her happy place. Ginger found love again outside of Hollywood, too. Like many other actresses, she went on a USO tour after the US entered World War II. While visiting the Marine base in San Diego, the Marine ordered to escort her around the base was Private First Class Jack Briggs. The two got along very well, and almost as just a courtesy, Ginger told Jack to call her up next time he was in LA. Well, he did call her up, and they fell instantly in love with each other. They got married 3 months after their first meeting, on January 16, 1943. A few weeks before Christmas that first year of their marriage, Jack, who was still enlisted, was sent off to war. Sadly, according to Ginger, he returned a completely different man. War will do that. They remained married for 5 years, but in the end, the marriage wasn't able to be saved. They divorced in 1948. In the summer of 1952, after Ginger's very long-term contract with RKO came to an end, she decided to take a trip to Europe. She'd always been working so hard through such long hours that she'd had very little time to enjoy herself and definitely very little time to travel. While in France, she met a very handsome new man, Jacques Bergerac. Sparks flew and they enjoyed a whirlwind romance. But Ginger had to eventually return home. But those sparks were pretty sparkly, I guess, because Jacques followed Ginger shortly after. And a few months after his arrival in the U.S., they were married. Ginger was 39 years old and married for the fourth time, and this was the first marriage for her new 25-year-old husband. She even got him a small part in her first film she did after the wedding, Twist of Fate. This marriage didn't last very long either. They got divorced in 1957 after 4 years. Ginger kept working steadily in movies, now in her third decade as a very busy and very successful film actress. The 1950s also opened her up to a new realm, television. She appeared on several television shows aside from her movie work. But, like so many other actors, she had a gnawing draw back to live theater. She missed that fulfillment that it provided. So, in 1957, after her fourth divorce, she put together a nightclub act. It opened in Havana, Cuba, and they moved to Las Vegas from there for a long engagement. After that, Ginger did some more plays. And then she thought she'd try marriage again. Fifth time's a charm. At 50 years old, Ginger Rogers married 44-year-old actor William Marshall in 1961. This marriage lasted 8 years, but ultimately ended in divorce as well. Ginger said she knew within 2 weeks that she had made a terrible mistake, but she let it go on for much too long. When he began stealing from her and cheating on her, that was it. By 1965, Ginger had decided she didn't love the direction Hollywood filmmaking and television production were heading. She was ready to close that long chapter of her book. She appeared in her final television show and her final motion picture in 1965. But she wasn't retiring. She wasn't done yet. She was going to focus all of her time and artistic energy to the stage. Next up, Hello, Dolly on Broadway. Ginger Rogers performed as Dolly with Hello, Dolly for 3 years, 1,116 performances. After Hello, Dolly, Ginger was really ready to take a little break. But that break didn't last long. After only 10 days of pure, relaxing bliss at her Oregon ranch in January of 1968, Ginger received a call from a London theater producer named Harold Fielding, and he wanted her to play the lead in Mame in London. Ginger moved to London and played Mame for 13 months. And she even performed for Queen Elizabeth II. And learned when the Queen and her sister, Princess Margaret, were little girls, they would pretend they were Fred and Ginger as they danced around the palace. Isn't that adorable? Ginger Rogers kept busy with television, live theater, and her nightclub acts throughout the 1970s. She had been working since she was a child. I think it was probably hard for her to live a life without work. She was also selected to be a celebrity fashion consultant for JCPenney and helped design her own line of lingerie for the company. Lingerie then was different than what lingerie is now. It was more like hosiery and undergarments, the intimates. She would travel the country and give interviews and talk about the intimates of pennies. In the spring of 1977, Ginger's best friend, her mother, Leela, became sick. So Ginger had to keep working at this point. She wanted to give her mother the very best care possible, no matter how much it cost. Ginger was on the road performing when her mother died. And she went on to still perform that night. Backstage, she was in a complete fog. But on the stage, she went on without anyone realizing anything was wrong. Maybe it was a bit of shock or denial, or maybe she was just that much of a professional. But after the show that night, she broke down. Her number one partner in her life, her best friend, was gone. Leela was Ginger's guiding light. She went to her for everything. Every decision in Ginger's life went through Leela first. She wasn't sure how she was going to survive without her. But she was grateful that she had been able to live a long, full life. She lived to be 85 years old. Ginger focused her energy on remembering that. I want to talk about Leela a little bit more. Leela Rogers was a very strong and intelligent woman. She was the kind of woman who saw a need and wanted to single-handedly provide the world with what she could to fulfill that need. If she thought she could help someone, she was going to help them. Leela Rogers was never an actress herself, except for one small role in one of Ginger's films playing her mother. But she had deep roots in show business and Hollywood itself from her years of management of her daughter's career and her own experience as a journalist in Hollywood years prior. She had coached her daughter through her dancing, her singing, her acting, her social etiquette. She thought she did a pretty good job with Ginger, and she thought she could probably help other aspiring stars too. She started a workshop called the Hollytown Theater, where she trained young actors and arranged for them to perform in plays in order to practice their skills. Her daughter Ginger's studio, RKO, was really impressed with Leela's little workshop, and they thought their young contract players could really benefit from something like it. So the studio hired Leela to form an RKO-exclusive theater workshop on the studio lot. You may remember one very famous workshop student at RKO who said she owes her entire career to Leela Rogers. Miss Lucille Ball. Betty Grable was also a student. Leela Rogers was a very effective and wildly beloved teacher at RKO. And the world lost a pretty remarkable woman when it lost her. But nobody felt her loss quite like Ginger Rogers did. Ginger did eventually finally figure out how to rest her body and mind and ease into the sunset of her life by the 1980s. But she still did appear in plenty of television shows, interviews, and award ceremonies. She lived a good life. She was a hard-working woman, very determined to succeed and be the best she could at her art. And she always remained very grateful for everything her life held. Ginger Rogers and her mother Leela were devout Christian Scientists, and they both leaned heavily on their faith and remained devoted to it throughout their entire lives. Ginger's faith guided her through every difficult time of her life. Ginger Rogers passed away at her beloved ranch in Oregon on April 25, 1995. She was 83 years old. Ginger was laid to rest right next to her beloved mother, Leela. And now I would like to share some other interesting things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. Ginger Rogers, one of the most iconic dancers in history, rated the following men as 10 out of 10 on her dance card. Dennis Morgan, Jimmy Stewart, and Cary Grant. Bullet point number two. Ginger Rogers was well known for her ice cream soda fountain that she had in her home. In fact, I watched an interview of her later in life where the very first thing she did was offer the interviewer an ice cream soda. It was quite the setup. Bullet point number three. Politics were very important to Ginger Rogers, almost as important as her Christian Science faith. She was a proud, lifelong Republican. Bullet point number four. Ginger Rogers was an artist, more than just what she brought to the silver screen and the dance floor. She was a painter and also did some sculpting, and she spent a lot of time doing this when she finally slowed down from her acting a bit. Bullet point number five. By the time Ginger Rogers teamed up with Fred Astaire for the first time on screen, she had already starred in about 20 movies. Although she is mostly known for her dancing partnership with Fred Astaire, she has a huge catalog of work outside of it. Bullet point number six. Ginger Rogers was a recipient of the Kennedy Center Honors for Lifetime Achievement in 1992. Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward were also recipients that year. Bullet point number seven. Ginger Rogers loved playing tennis, and she loved going fishing. In conclusion, Ginger Rogers may be best known for being Fred Astaire's dance partner, but I think it's really important for us to know how much more she gave the world outside of those 10 movies they did together. Yes, they were amazing together, but Ginger was amazing on her own. Ginger had such an amazing role model in her mother, Leela Rogers. Leela was always there to advocate for her daughter, but she also wanted her to fight her own fights. She was there for Ginger in every question about life she had. She helped her through every decision she had to make. They were best friends. I feel so many similarities to Ginger and Leela's relationship with my relationship with my own mother, who is celebrating her birthday this week. Like Leela, my mom has always advocated for me. She will always be my guide in life, the person I go to for help in navigating through this world. She is my biggest cheerleader. She cheers me on through my career as a teacher, and she cheers me on through this little podcast and everything else I do. She is hands down the number one fan of this show. And she is the best travel companion I could ever ask for. We spent my childhood traveling all over the U.S. every summer, and as an adult, I'm fortunate to have my mom as my international travel partner. We've traveled to Norway together, Scotland, Ireland, England, Spain, Greece. Who knows where we'll end up next? I am forever grateful to have those memories. The older I get and the more loss I experience, the more I realize just how lucky we all are to be able to celebrate another birthday. I am 45 years old and I still have my mom around. Many people aren't fortunate enough to be able to say that. And my mom is even lucky enough to say it. She still has her mom around. And I tell ya, sometimes I can't keep up with either of them. We are truly blessed. So, happy birthday to my mom. And thank you for being my biggest cheerleader. Thank you all for listening. My primary source for this episode was Ginger Rogers' autobiography, My Story by Ginger Rogers. I also used an article from Vanity Fair by Hadley Hall Mears from August 17th, 2023. And, of course, IMDb.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hi, listeners. Grace Anna here, host of Art Muse, a podcast that shares the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art. In doing so, Art Muse aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret these well-known works by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. Each episode focuses our attention on a specific female muse, sharing their important life and legacy. By sharing these women's stories, we are given the opportunity to appreciate artworks from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Season 3 continues to share the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art, this time focusing on artist models who were also performers in their own right. Season 3 will begin its release this fall. We cannot wait to share these amazing women's stories with you. In the meantime, we hope you continue to enjoy Season 1 and 2 of Art Muse, available on all streaming platforms. Until next time, bye for now.